Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who do or do not go to church, and for those who are disillusioned. How, as a Christian, do you cope with starting a new job, only to find that after a few weeks, you're in hospital with a rare disease? Recovery took 4 years. So what do you do, and what can it do to your faith? It gives me great pleasure to talk to Linda Gould, who in the Northern Ireland Troubles worked in the Belfast City YMCA, which helped her later on to run peace and reconciliation programmes. But what was it like during those times? And again, what did it do for her faith? Linda, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Really appreciate you taking valuable time out of work. Before we answer all those questions and more, fingers on the buzzers, no conferring please, Linda. 5 questions coming your way. Are you ready?
Oh, I think so.
And by the way, if you want to contact us, you're more than welcome. It's ogc@accessradio.biz. That's ogc@accessradio.biz. And biz is spelled B-I-Z. Question number one then, Linda. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, what would it be?
Oh, I think I'd have to go sort of political, Martin. And I would invite David Irvine. David sadly passed away, but he was leader of the Progressive Unionist Party.
Okay.
A very interesting character. There was a statue in his memory just of a lovely, soft, squidgy chair and a pair of shoes just sitting under it, but they had to move it because it became a taxi depot. But apart from that, he was actually, played a fundamental part in encouraging loyalism into the peace process. And so I'd really be fascinated at the minute. My question probably would be about what his analysis is of things at the moment in terms of Northern Ireland and our stalemate once again. And I'd be particularly interested in his views on the protocol, just whether it's as important an issue, a principal issue, in light of people suffering with the cost of living crisis.
When did David die, Linda?
Oh, gosh, I'd say it's over 10 years ago, but I might be wrong on that one. I better check that one up and reply by email.
Yes, can't do it by post at the moment, but yes. No. That's a great answer. Yeah. Thank you. Question 2. Who is your favourite biblical character, or your favourite biblical story, or your favourite parable, please?
Oh, it has to be the parable of the talents. That one has been thrown at me all of my days about just how it probably resonates more with the Protestant work ethic than it does what I think biblically it means. But it's often portrayed as a story that's a kingdom story, but I'm not quite sure that it is. It's certainly a story for me of an anti-hero rather than one that it's often used to say whether the person who seems to be the anti-hero is the one who's chastised at the end. So we assume it's a story about the kingdom, but actually it's something more, I think, of the one who exposes the injustice of the master. It would take much longer than what you intend if I were to go into that one, but it's a fascinating story, because we have severed most of our parables from real life situations. So we've stripped it of the socioeconomic context in which it was written. And if you find the right writer, you'll find a fascinating counter story to that particular parable and a few others besides.
I've got to ask you, you said 3 words there, Protestant work ethic.
Yes. Is that an unfamiliar thing for you?
Not those 3 words. Maybe together in the same sentence, yes. But for those around the world that are thinking, well, sure. What does that mean? What does that mean, please?
Well, I think, I come from a sociology background, and it was very much part of the understanding that there is a mindset that is taught. It's probably not taught in terms of sitting down in a classroom, but it's communicated through how you're kind of encouraged to work hard, to not be dependent on people, to make sure that you're autonomous and that you put in a good day's work. And all of that equates then with honouring God in the Christian world, so that you inherit very quickly a drivenness and a sense of you're really not honouring God if you're not working 26 hours out of the 24 that God gives you. And you certainly don't engage in Sabbath rest because, you know, Sunday's a busy day for God, so you've got to put in another 26 out of 24 hours as well. So, I think it's more of a sociological term that reflects just a culture within Protestantism.
Is there such a thing as a Catholic work ethic then, to balance it out?
Not that I've heard of.
No, not in sociology terms.
No.
Got you.
No.
But that's what it means. Thank you. See, we learn something new every day over here. Question three. If you were Prime Minister for the day. And last
That's
more,
perfectly possible.
It is, isn't it? And you lasted more than 46 days. If you were Prime Minister for the day and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be?
I'm not sure it might be a law, but I think I would love to try and enact a new commitment to the welfare state. I think something of that has been lost over the last number of years, because the state has an incredible responsibility to care for its citizens, particularly the vulnerable. What I'm seeing in Northern Ireland, and I think across the rest of the UK, is government now outsourcing this responsibility to the community and voluntary sector, and to churches as well. I'm also seeing the government sell off bits of the NHS to private enterprise. So, you know, there's a whole story there about government's chronic underfunding of the NHS and possibly Northern Ireland too in terms of the block grants. So I would want to do something that stopped that big sell-off, and just something that restored a belief in the common good again.
Great answer. Thank you. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out?
Oh, it has to be a trip to Newfoundland in Canada.
Oh, really?
It was just a stop-off point on going to see family. There's quite strong connections between Northern Ireland and Canada. And I was going out to see a cousin. And my friend and I were travelling together, and we stopped off in Newfoundland. And we went to visit. There's a massive marble granite. Well, I think it's granite more than marble, but it's this big cathedral up on a hill. And we were just fascinated by it, turned up. And on that day, there was like a monologue happening. So it was a narration of the history of the cathedral. Turns out was an Irish priest that initiated it, built it, sourced material in Galway, and brought it all across the Atlantic. Fascinating story. And you have to, at the time, it was, I think it was 2016. So we'd just come through Brexit.
Yes.
Trump was running for power. We had ended up at the back of the church talking to two Canadian women who were utterly fascinated with why the UK had voted to come out of Europe. So we had a massive conversation about that. And then we had about another hour-long conversation about Trump at that stage. And it was just one of those kind of moments out of the blue, just four women standing in the midst of this big stone building, a big church. And at the end of it, we just said, look, if you're ever in Ireland, come and visit. Well, lo and behold, they did. And both of them couldn't come at the same time, so we ended up hosting two visits and just have established a wonderful connection across the Atlantic with two wonderful women from Vancouver. So now that COVID's over, that's what we're hoping for, a wee trip out to British Columbia and to renew those acquaintances.
Brilliant. Sorry, if you hear a squeak, by the way, it's my rocking chair, this wooden rocking chair, because it's absolutely fantastic for my back. But that's another story altogether. Yeah, and if you want to upset a Canadian, of course, just tell them that they're part of the United States. That's all you got to do.
Every time. You've got to carefully listen for the Northern Irish nuances in their accents, the house and the out.
Oh, really?
Out. Oh, yeah. Yep, definitely. You'll pick up the Northern Irish, especially in Newfoundland.
Wow.
Yeah. And Nova Scotia.
Wow, fantastic. Fantastic. Well, question five then. What has been your most embarrassing moment to date?
I'm embarrassed to tell this one because it still haunts me, but it has to be a time when I was doing youth work and I took the kids away on an outdoor trip. We were camping under canvas and it had rained and it rained and it rained. So the ground was particularly soggy. So teenagers being teenagers, they'd squirreled away their Alcopops in the bottom of their bag and waiting for the cover of darkness to bring them out. But I'd found out and I found them. And of course, there was the obligatory telling off and the long telling off that you feel justified in doing. It's not just enough to say you did wrong. You have to tell them how wrong they were. And so I just in the Northern Ireland, that we've an expression, I ate the bake off them. So they got it right between the eyes. Well, I wore them out with my judgment of their behaviour and then promptly turned to go back to my tent. You can just picture the scene. There they are sitting in the tent, well chastened by my ire and my careful words that I'd chosen. And as I self-righteously stepped out to walk across the field back to my tent, well, I just slipped in the mud and I just slid a good 100 yards. All I can say is young people won, youth worker nil. Totally embarrassed.
And of course, they saw it.
Oh, absolutely. And had to stifle a laugh because they were scared of getting another earful. But I just, that's one I keep going back to. And I just still think, oh, you can't tell people. I'm more embarrassed by me telling them off now, probably, than sliding in the mud. Well, getting covered in clobber.
Yeah, just saying that about being working on the camp and stuff, that takes me back to when I was doing my days as camp sports commie, as I was called in those days, or a lot of things behind my back, no doubt, as well. And I remember going to one tent late one night. I can't remember why they were really naughty, but they were. For some reason, and I went in there, and all I could muster at the end of the day was, "Have you heard of Dr. Crippen?" No. So I explained who Dr. Crippen was, and I said, "Why was he hanged?" And they said, "We don't know." I said, "Because he got caught," and that was it. And hopefully, they were able to put two and two together that if you're going to make noises, do it quietly.
Very good. You see, you are much more gracious, Martin. I was that self-righteous. Oh, I just had to tell them they were wrong and had done wrong and broken all the rules.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to me that night. That was
I could have taken a leaf out of your book.
If only. Yeah. Well, listen, it's been great that you're joining us anyway. And in my little monologue at the beginning, that's a good word, I've mentioned quite a few things that you did. And obviously it'd be great to end up with you talking about NICVA and who you work for. Mm-hmm. As opposed to NIVEA, which is something completely different.
Correct.
Yeah. Although that does stand, maybe that could stand for actually something like Northern Irish Volunteers Evangelistic Association or something. That'd be the cream then, wouldn't they? But let's look at something, go right back to the beginning, if that's all right, something that I said. And that, you know, you're in a new job. We'll talk about that later on. But it's the troubles, because I obviously live over here in Northern Ireland, but plenty of people listen who might have heard of the troubles in Northern Ireland. But you've already mentioned sociological background. So please just tell us what it was like living in the troubles and what it was all about, please.
Sure. I mean, I grew up in a context, I lived in the suburbs of the city, and I found it interesting, you know, talking to my mum and dad at different points about what was going on, that there was less conversation about it than with people I worked with when I went to work, who were living in either inner city or, you know, closer to areas where the conflict was particularly stark and real. And I think that totally shaped my understanding of a conflict in society that was had multi, they're just multi facets to it. I remember taking a youth trip to the States, and one of the promoters on the American side asked me, could you in 3 minutes tell me about the conflict and the troubles in Northern Ireland? And I just said, no, I can't. 10 minutes, maybe. But it's just hard to condense. We had an awful time. I mean, I even find it hard to talk about now, because there were just moments at which I was not given, nor did I seek out, the means to understand what was going on. I mean, at a simplistic level, we had two tribes, the Protestant Unionist and Loyalist, and the other Catholic Nationalist and Republican in orientation, and strong identities, both making different claims about this little part of the United Kingdom. And that process was lived out in everything from what paper you read, what sport you take, what school you would go to, everything in your life was shaped by particular demarcations. And the city centre, when I worked in it in the 1980s, became a bit of a battleground in terms of who owns this space. It was often portrayed to be a neutral space. And then across the city, there were ghettos to some degree of one tribe or the other. But the city centre was a social space that was meant to be for all. But it was a fascinating space because you had the normal youth culture sitting in on the top of that. So at one point we had a big mod culture in the 80s, inspired by Quadrophenia.
Yeah,
we had massive kind of movement of skinheads at one point. We had then the goth movement. So like City Centre became the only space where young people could really gather. And at that time, the City of Belfast YMCA was probably the only show in town in terms of doing a youth work in that context. Young people used to gather around the City Hall and the YMCA was just literally around the corner from it. So I really wasn't equipped to understand what the conflict was about. Even now, if somebody had asked me to say what it was in three sentences or 3 minutes, I would really struggle. I mean, I am struggling to answer just the general question about what it is. The only thing to note is that we had like over 3,500 people killed, which somebody worked out to be like 9/11 happening every day for a whole month in proportion to the population.
Yes.
And that has massive consequences because now post-agreement, we're coming now to 25 years anniversary, but you could have walked into the city centre and met the person that killed your relative. It's a small population. And in that context, it was a very personal war, although the government never called it a war. Again, one of the issues. But it was a fractured time that still exists in people's psyches. And actually, you can still see it in the landscape of the city. We have more peace walls now than we had even during the Troubles. But we have physical walls that separate communities still. And of those walls, you know, some of them are new built post-agreement because we are people who live out our identities in a very peculiar way. It's not unknown, you know, in other parts of the UK, but it just is known under different things. Football does it. I would say Brexit was an expression of English nationalism more than it was anything else. So there are ways in which we can see the same thing writ large. We often get accused of being the most sectarian part of the UK, but I find Guy Fawkes Night a fascinating night. There's an anti-sectarian statement and festival in the English calendar and a moment of anti-Catholicism. I think even in terms of who, you know, royalty, you can't be Catholic and queen or king, I believe prime minister wise, I don't think the prime minister can be Catholic. Didn't Tony Blair become a Catholic after he stepped down as prime minister? So there are ways in which what we've experienced here is writ large in other parts of the UK, but it's just not as obvious as ours.
The thing about Guy Fawkes is an interesting thing, but I don't want to get because I know plenty of Catholic schools in back in England, and they'd celebrate it, you know, and that was the thing. Back in the 80s and 70s, me growing up in England, it was on the news all the time, you know, and somebody's, you know, we see the explosions going on. In England, it didn't matter if you were Catholic or Protestant, but over here, it really did. And for you to say that, you know, you couldn't sum it up in three sentences, I think is a very wise thing. So taking that fully forward then, why did you get involved with the YMCA in the first place?
For me, it had really come as somebody put the job in front of me. I mean, I'd been training to do personnel management, which was really a bit bizarre. I'd gone on one of those kind of junior management courses after finishing university. I hadn't really been able to find work. And I saw this job and somebody said, you should go for that, because I had been doing youth work in my church prior to that. But I was also taken with the mid-70s, one of the guys in our youth fellowship had been murdered by the IRA. And it was one of those kind of moments. I think most people can look back on their life and you see a series of seminal moments. And that was one of the, for me, a big interruption in my ignorance of what was happening in the context in which I was living. And John Donaldson was his name. He died in October in 75, and he had actually just been, he started a new job. He was a solicitor and was going, he went to one of the police stations in West Belfast, which was predominantly Republican at that point, and he was taking a statement from a police officer. So on his way back to the office, he was shot by the IRA, who apologised as a you know, it was mistaken identity. And from that, that was my first moment in which my faith kind of got rooted into a time and a place. And it had begun then over the following years as I went through university. It made me start to think about this faith has to be lived somewhere. And so it seemed sensible to think, right, well, let's just go and see what this might mean if I go and work in the city centre. And it was a great job. It was funded by the government. It was part of the old YTP, it was here, Youth Training Programme. Yeah. And so we were the programme that we picked up the young people that had been sacked or kicked out of all of the other programmes from the government training centre. So if you failed our programme, you know, you really, there was nowhere else to go. Mm-hmm. And for me, it just gave me a whole understanding of the city. I had only learnt my side of the city. I knew the university area, but I didn't really know anything of West or North Belfast. And I remember, you know, taking the YMCA minibus out and just driving around some of the flashpoints and places where you were driving past burnt out buses or cars, just to pick up the young people, because if they didn't make it into work, that would be it for them. Mm-hmm. And you were dragging them out of their beds nearly just to get them into work, just so that you were trying to give them a fresh start or give them an opportunity. And I think that was always in me, you know, even in the youth work I'd done in my church, it was always just trying to do the best for young people and give them a fresh start. So that was probably the biggest motivation. And it was a bit of a, I don't know, like you've probably met this in yourself, the Messiah complex. You do have a sense that you can save the world when you're young and idealistic as a young Christian. I'd become a Christian myself in about 75. And it was just that real sense of, yeah, I'm going to, you know, save the world. And that is the motivation. And I had been on an evangelism training school, so I was all gung-ho, ready to get out there. Mm. Even as I say that, I just think how far I've travelled from that point.
Wow. Excuse me. So that's how you got in, and to go with your faith. That is some really good thing to have, though, as your motivation, to save the world as part of it, but to give somebody a fresh start, a new start, which we can allude to, you know, the parable of the talents that you said as well. So how did you get more involved with peace and reconciliation programmes then?
I don't think I'd appreciated how much I did 8 years in that role in the YMCA, and then I actually left to go to university and train properly as a youth worker. Mm-hmm. And when I come out from that, I began doing youth work training, and that brought me into contact with a lot of youth workers who were working right across Northern Ireland. It was a national organisation I worked for, and I just realised that we were limping our way, you know, with maybe one or two Bible stories, and there were, you know, just very few theologians even willing to sit down and try and give a better biblical understanding of what the conflict was in Northern Ireland. And I think for me, I had just not thought to apply the text in the context of the Troubles. And that wasn't happening in churches. It wasn't happening in any of the kind of big youth movements at that time. And it struck me, I read just a report that had been prepared that said the churches in Northern Ireland were great chaplains to their communities, but there were no kind of prophetic voices to speak to the context of violence. Mm-hmm. And some of it rooted in a faith identity. So, I mean, the Troubles have many component parts to it, to what makes it. So, but there definitely was a faith component in terms of it being that somebody's faith identity as Protestant and as Catholic had created part of the divisions that existed and still exist. And that was not being unpicked widely. There were certain groups doing that. Corrymeela, the Columbanus community. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a number of different community projects that were doing it, but largely I felt churches were quite silent about the fact that we had this war as the backdrop to how we were doing faith, but no help to connect the essence of the faith and the reconciling story that is embedded in Christianity into the context of a conflict that really was about identity and who we are, and part of that being who we are in Christ. And I suppose it sits in the fact that many in the Protestant churches didn't believe people in the Catholic Church were Christian. Mm-hmm. And that still exists today. There's still an evangelistic zeal to convert Catholics. And within Catholicism, there wasn't necessarily the understanding. I remember, you know, working in Youth Link, which was an interdenominational youth agency. And there was just kind of the language of non-Catholic. So there's Catholic and non-Catholic, without understanding the incredible diversity within Protestantism and the distinctives that go with each of those diverse expressions. And so that was, for me, it was, again, everything's just been like little kickstarts to, that can't be right. I need to rescue it. I need to do something about it. It's just been a pathology all my life, I think. and I'm sure there's therapy out there for such moments now. But that put me into the way of an organisation called ECONI, which was Evangelical Contribution on Northern Ireland. And a group of evangelicals had been challenging something that was written nearly on every Protestant gable wall, which said "For God and Ulster." That was the connection between the faith component and the political identity mm-hmm. that was at the heart of the conflict. And so this group of evangelicals established this organization to nuance that statement in terms of, you know, that kind of challenge or that connection between this is a God is on our side, I suppose, is what essentially came out of that kind of statement. And that led me then to become a program director for a number of different programs, mostly within Protestant churches, but not exclusively. We would run like a summer school every summer, and that would be open to anyone to come to try and make sense of the conflict. And we would do that in July. You'll know just how this country is in July. We like to walk and we like to parade, and that is the nub of the season of parading. And we would have used that moment as an experiential moment to allow people to question and ask, what is happening here? And what does this mean, and how can I understand it? And in those summer schools, we would have a lot of Catholic folks who would have come along just to try and make sense of it. And then that was a great moment. We would always have invited others to come and help us see what was happening through the lens of others who are not from this place. So we would have had folks from the States come, folks from England, Scotland, Wales, just to help create the place where people can look. You get a little window in to just some of the cultural expressions and then begin to unpick those, and then to see what out of this can you trace back to how people have understood what it is to be Protestant as a faith identity, and then look to see how that has been set against what it is to be Catholic. So it was a very particular way in which we looked at peace and reconciliation.
What's your terminology for reconciliation then?
I think it's probably rooted in just the biblical piece that talks about Christ as the reconciler of all things in the whole cosmos. I think in Northern Ireland, and certainly as I grew up as a Christian, reconciliation was really understood to be between me and God. And it was about my sin and my, you know, my need for salvation. Yeah. And rooted then in atonement, I probably have come a long way to seeing it as a story that begins in a garden but ends in a city. What I was nurtured in was a story that starts in a garden and ends in a garden, Gethsemane. And I never really understood much about what happened past Gethsemane, because the story of reconciliation really was about my broken relationship with Christ. I hadn't been equipped. I really don't think I was equipped to do anything about the fracturing or brokenness of relationships in the world around me. And so when I began to look at how Christ breaks down the hostility and dividing walls, it just was you couldn't get more stark example and no better way to take that text than to stand, you know, somewhere like Lanark Way, where you see 80 foot of dividing wall in our city. That separates two communities, and start to review that text and understand it in context. It changes everything about what is the vocation of a church in a divided society and what is my vocation as a Christian and follower of Jesus in this particular context. And I mean, I challenge anyone, if anybody's interested, give me a call. I will take them to some of the places across the city,
yeah,
and we'll stand and we'll take the Word of God and open it. And you are changed when you read it in situ, particularly where you see the pain of communities segregated still, and you have to review what you've understood reconciliation to mean, because it's messy, it's untidy, it's long-term, and it means you have to get involved. We pray too easily and too lightly for the reconciliation of all things without recognizing how hard it is, because you're talking about age-old divisions, and you're talking about histories. You know, today is you know, a day when we commemorate and remember great wars, and we've built cenotaphs all across our great cities and all of that. And cenotaphs in that context are set up to say an awful thing happened and let's not do it again. In Northern Ireland, we built little mini cenotaphs, and that's one of the places I would take people to with the text. And you would see this memorial to the people who died in that community. But unlike the kind of big national cenotaphs, they tell a story of an awful thing happened here, and it was those people over there that did it. Mm-hmm. So there isn't that capacity. There are things that have not been resolved, and that's a harder space in which to bring the reconciling imagery of the Bible and the power of Christ to reconcile all things to Christ's self is a harder one to get your head around. But I think that's what we're called to. It's too easy just to say people need Jesus. Yes, of course they need Jesus, but how and in what context? And how do you live Jesus in a community when we all live in our, well, and I'm talking about myself, we live out in the suburbs, and you know, we're not living alongside these fractured lines in our community.
You've obviously been beating this drum for several years now with youth in the 70s and 80s, all the way through to today. I wouldn't mind betting that probably the biggest problem you've faced are people who go to church themselves within your denomination, for instance. What kind of feedback did you get from them of the negative kind? To give us a bigger picture of what the troubles must really been like.
Do you know, I find myself, because I was doing youth work, you work nights, you work, even doing youth work training, you work nights and you work weekends. So I found myself become quite detached from the normal life of my own congregation, just by my work pattern and work routine. But it did mirror a detachment from myself as a person of faith, because I couldn't find ways to connect in. I do remember sitting in a small group one night, and it was probably the night I decided I would not go back to small group, because I'd spent the day talking to a young person who had just gambled away all of their weekly pay, and they were scared to go home because their father was going to hammer them. And I was again, it's not an embarrassing moment, but a moment when I'm ashamed of my attitude. I sanctimoniously told them they needed to budget better and shouldn't have gambled, instead of just putting my hand in my pocket and giving them 30 quid. But that besides, I was carrying the weight of that and wanted to go to a small group that said, you know, here's this fractured world, kids are struggling to get by. And I went to the home group, and there was a guy there, all he wanted to talk about was how many horse soldiers Nehemiah had. And I just thought, I'm out of kilter here. I'm the one, you know, I took it to myself, I think, that I'm the one who doesn't quite know how to fit in here. Because what I was preoccupied about, what I didn't have answers for, wasn't going to be answered in a head count in terms of Nehemiah's battle and struggles. Now, probably I could make a better stab at it now, and see parallels or see metaphors across that whole story. But at that time, it just seemed like I had travelled a different road. And I found it harder and harder then to reconnect, because a lot of what we were doing in small group material, just even in terms of sermon titles, seemed remote and maybe distanced. We took up a series at one point, and I think I was working. Again, I moved jobs and I worked part-time for the church for a while. And I remember looking at, it was a series. So they were like one book a year. And I opened the first book and the first question was, where was Jesus born? And I thought, well, I'm going to die because I'm going to have to wait till book 13 or something before I get something that's going to wrestle my brain or give me the kind of connectedness between theology and practice that just seemed to be so missing in the world that I grew up in. And I didn't really blame people. I think we just have a wider church culture that looks for packages. We do it now with Alpha, Christianity Explored, Discipleship Explored. And inevitably they're written so that they can apply everywhere, which, and unless you've got someone who knows how to apply them in the very place that they're being delivered, then they just sit as if they float above the context, if you know what I mean. They just kind of, they never bed themselves into, you know, working with, you know, say it's a congregation that's running these in an inner city church. That's vastly different to somebody's out in the suburbs or somebody's in a rural context to an urban. Somebody in a church that's just on the verge of closing is going to read the scripture far differently to someone whose church is thriving. And the fact that we miss that in all of the material, I don't really blame people for not getting it. I think we've got a discipleship culture that doesn't really help people make those strong connections. And I wouldn't even know how to teach it myself, apart from going places. That experiential learning approach has been my approach all along. Take people to a place, see what God says and what God's word says. And how do you read it when you're not in... you're not in the comfort of a lovely church hall or somebody's living room, but you're actually standing in front of the ugliness of a city or the pain of a community that just is constantly tortured by the dynamic of living in that particular place.
Well, I've got to commend you because last Friday I went in to Belfast on my Todd on the train, had a great time at a gig and came out. And do you know what? Walking around Belfast about 10:30, going back to the train, I've never felt so safe in all my life. The buzz, seeing people going into restaurants, you know, it was fantastic. Not a soldier in sight. So, you know, well done to people like yourselves who, you know, battled through it in the 80s and 90s. Because I doubt if you weren't around, if Corey Mueller wasn't around, you know, other people from both sides of the Christian faith, I wouldn't have been doing that on Friday night. So,
Well, I was well back in the queue. I mean, mine was very safe. I worked with a lot of people who were frontline, and I commend them. I mean, I had an easy route into it because I had a warm audience in many ways because people wanted to try and understand what was going on. But there are others whose lives were put on hold at times because it really cost them. So I take commendation, but not I'd say it's, there's so many others who really did lose reputation, some, you know, just lost so much for taking the risk and sticking their head up and saying things that were painful for churches to hear, but I think we've all learned and grown, but you only learn for the moment that you're in sometimes. And
I think to summarize what you're saying, okay, I know somebody who swears by you as like most probably saving his life, right? Because you took it upon yourself to look after him, to bring him through when he was going through all his troubles in the 70s and 80s. You saw something in him and you stood by him so that, you know, he could achieve what he's achieving 30 years on. So it is fantastic. You showed Christian love in action, in other words, which is fantastic. Talking of which, right, let's move on slightly, if that's all right. And that it sounds really as if your faith has been challenged, which is fantastic. You start a new job and almost immediately end up in hospital. Faith challenged again. What happened?
Oh, my word. What a surprise. I mean, the peace and reconciliation work kind of came to an abrupt end in some ways. I mean, it started out as a one-year post, and then we kept getting renewing funding. But then eventually the funding did run out as we progressed away from the peace agreement in 98. And so I then started looking around for new work and got a job in East Belfast Mission, inner east part of Belfast. And within 3 weeks, ended up with a very rare condition. Obviously didn't know that at the moment, but I ended up, the Queen came to visit, actually. She came and was going to meet people. This was her first visit in I don't even know how long. Mm-hmm. And at that stage, I'd been offered a place in hospital because I was so ill, even though I didn't know it, and ended up going into hospital. And after 3 weeks, I was diagnosed with a very rare condition. It's called cerebral vasculitis. So it's one of the vasculitis where your own body starts to attack itself, in a sense. So your own immune system starts to undermine your own body's reaction. So I had just an inflammation in the blood vessels at the back of my brain. So it just started messing with everything. It was kind of all the symptoms of a small stroke and these thunderclap headaches. So I did very well. I certainly very well looked after in the hospital I was at. And my own GP, I think I would credit her with saving my life, because I hadn't had a great experience of the emergency department. But it was a very sobering moment in my life where I realised my own body was telling me something and I hadn't been listening. And while I don't think it was a crazy lifestyle that created it, I think it just was a moment when my body just reacted to something. I think it became a bit of a metaphor for me about looking after my life. And, you know, if I'd had this condition in the 1980s, I probably would have died. As opposed to have been, you know, put on the right course of treatment. And over a period of 4 years, it was 4 years before I was off all the medication, I had to rethink my life and rethink priorities, rethink what can I do out of this situation? Because I still would have some nerve damage. I still have moments when I get particularly fatigued. Yeah. So I have to think, if I do that, I can't do this. One of the things that I've kept going, because you always forget, like even in the heat of the moment, you know, you think, right, I'm never going to do that again. And of course you don't, especially if you're addressing a messiah complex in your life. Mm-hmm. You get back into the way of thinking, I could save the world.
Yeah.
But I do remember, and this is something that has endured, I would sit, if somebody invited me to a meeting, I would have to say, right, what's the agenda? Because I needed to figure out what's my contribution to that meeting. And if I couldn't figure that out, I wouldn't go, because if I went to that, I couldn't go to something else the next day or something that evening. So it was a bargaining. Yeah. You had a certain amount of energy for a day or for a week. And usually you had to work out what you were going to give your attention to. And actually, it was a really good discipline. Even to this day, I struggle to go to a meeting where I don't know what the agenda is, which I think in faith worlds is quite common. You know, you'll get an agenda, you'll get a meeting set up, and yeah, we'll meet to talk about, and I'll go, talk about what, you know, and how long are we going to be talking for, and what is the purpose, and all of that. You know, you become the pain in the backside for someone, because you want to know why am I going? Do I need to be there? And I think that has been a good discipline, just to say, you can't do everything. And so my condition sits at the back of my life. The consultant, just as I was discharged, said, it's either in remission or it's gone. You won't know till you know. And so I live in that kind of liminal space, betwixt and between, you know, believing that it's gone, which is the more positive side, but also thinking, well, just don't be too stupid in your behaviors. Just try to keep a balance, because you don't want to get to that situation where maybe something becomes a trigger again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's one of the things I love about it is the communities that it's brought me in touch with. There are support groups. There's a Vasculitis UK support group, and then Vasculitis group in Ireland called Vasculitis Awareness Ireland. And I've just met such wonderful people who all have different forms of this that affect different organs, the lungs, the brain, kidneys, liver, nerves. You know, people are affected in so many ways. And I've never met such a resilient community of people who just get up every morning and think, right, okay, I'm just going to get through today.
Yeah.
People's tenacity, people who've had to have facial reconstruction because it has eroded body parts, yes. Everything. And a lot of these are very rare Mine is one in a million, literally. I can put that on my gravestone, should I have one.
She was one in a million.
Absolutely. And there are people who are now championing this. Brexit was a big issue for people with rare disease because in the UK, my rare is particularly rare. But if you put me in the context of Europe, I'm not quite so rare. And therefore, more funding goes towards, you know, working on cures, working on better treatments. But the moment you cut yourself off and, you know, from that kind of community and the funding that was needed to support medical improvements and that, there's a lot of people now in the rare disease category who've become quite isolated because of that severing of that relationship. Never thought about because it was all about something else. You know, but it's a sobering thing, and it is, it's very good. It still does shape my thinking. I declare it when I go for work. I lost hearing as part of it, the medication. I got tinnitus and I lost hearing in both ears. I don't hear the high frequencies, so wear hearing aids. But actually that again gave me opportunities to understand the world of hearing loss as well. So there's a richness comes. I wouldn't say it was something I really am glad about, but you know, I've seen ways in which it has just opened up my eyes to other people's worlds and the way in which they see the world shaped by infirmity and by difficulties just existing.
So how's, after all this, okay, what you've been through on the physical, what you've been through growing up here in Northern Ireland, where's your faith now then?
Do you know, I think my faith is probably, I'm going to say mature because that makes me sound good. I'm in my 60s now, and wow. I think you get to a point, you know, you come through your 20s and you think you know everything. You get to your 30s and you know that you know everything, but you think you're being humble as you hold it. You know, you get to your 40s, your 50s, you get to your 60s and you kind of think, you know, I don't really care what other people think. And you think, right, what do I think? You know, I've only got, I don't know if it's 3 score years and 10. I've got 10 years left, you know. I'm kind of hoping there's a wee bit more than that. Absolutely.
Well, inflation, don't forget.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll take all of that on top. But I think I have begun to understand my faith. I've come so far from the wee girl that went to a Campus Crusade summer discipleship school where I learned to tell my testimony in 3 minutes and could recite the 4 spiritual laws from cover to cover without the book in my hand, to where I am now in how I try to live faith in whatever place God puts me and with the people that I meet around me. And so I probably would say that I'm more comfortable in my own skin as a Christian now. I could argue, if I should feel the need to argue the story of Jesus, but it would be so different to what it was when I learnt it by rote. I think now there is something about knowing this story from garden to city and being excited more by the city aspect of it and the notion that there will be a new heaven and a new earth. And, you know, I remember kind of at one point being so disappointed at the thought that heaven was the end game, you know. And for me, it almost felt like, you know, when you fly out from here and you try to get into Heathrow, you often are in that holding pattern. Yeah. And that struck me at one point in my life, you know, that actually the best that we've done, if atonement is at the center of our story of Jesus, the best that we've done is give people a slot in the holding pattern until either they die or Christ returns. And we haven't done much to explain about what you do in the interim, you know, what do you do in that space. Whereas for me, the story that takes me to the new heaven and the new earth is invigorating. You know, it's that notion that the kingdom is coming and that I actually can be part of contributing to the kingdom come. And I love, I mean, I think I've learned how to hope. That's probably the thing that sticks in my heart and my head the most is the story of hope, because it is just so, it's a story that's just riddled throughout the whole Bible, you know. And in the Bible, hope, the metaphor for hope is light. So from the very first page of the Bible, you've got the story of light coming into being, but you've got the same story of light on the last page when Jesus says that he is the Alpha, the Omega, and he describes himself as the bright morning star. Now, that star is the star that appears at the darkest part of the night. It's the star that heralds the dawn. So it's the star that almost hauls the light in behind it. And for Jesus to equate himself with that star, I just find so exciting. It's such a brilliant visual image of Jesus just on the cusp of hauling in the new kingdom behind him. And so, you know, if the kingdom is both here and still to come, I want to be active and participate in the kingdom come now. And so I want to be that herald of hope, in a sense, and want to see how do you live out Christian faith in a way that is genuine and meaningful and brings life and hope to people. And so therefore, for me, I still believe in a story of atonement, but it's not front and center in the story that I tell about Christ. I think I hold fast to telling more the story of the light that is to come, the morning star kind of story, and the story that ends in a city, and that there's a recreation coming.
Yes.
You know, that God hasn't given up on us. He's not abandoned us, but there is more to come.
Well, talking about more to come, we've only got 10 minutes. And it's been, I've been listening to you for hours because it's brilliant what you're sharing. Which leads on, because, you know, you're talking at work, you're talking about Jesus. Now, there'd be plenty of firms across the water. You can't possibly do that. You know, how dare you? And all that sort of stuff. So tell us more about NICFA then, NICVA.
Yes, so NICFA is the Northern Ireland Council for Voluntary Action. That's what it stands for. And it's an umbrella body for the community and voluntary sector. So it's a membership body. And from it, we would listen to the voices of the wider community and voluntary sector. We'd look to support that sector with just information around good governance, fundraising, all of the things that help these organisations survive, particularly post, you know, through COVID and now the cost of living crisis. And within that, we have a faith engagement programme, which is funded by one of the government departments, and it's funded to build up the infrastructure of the faith sector where it engages in community work. So it's not about funding faith work, but it's about funding the work, not funding, but supporting the work that faith groups engage in when they are reaching out into the community. So I would be supporting groups, helping them, you know, think about what their involvement in the community could be if they haven't started, or just helping with just some of the fundraising challenges, or helping them get their organization in good order, you know, in terms of their good governance guidelines. And many of these groups are all charities, and charity law, most of them don't know how to get their head around, and helping them understand what their role is as charity trustees, even practical things like how to chair meetings, how to call a meeting, how to do all the practical stuff. A lot of people are just volunteers, and nobody ever showed them how to do that sort of thing. So a lot of small congregations, churches, faith groups that have started then to work in the community just need a bit of practical help and support. So it's a great environment in which to come in with my faith background, but also practical youth work backgrounds, peace and reconciliation. It's like everything's just kind of led me to this kind of role at this point in my life, which I'm very glad about.
Yeah, it's a friend of mine, I haven't seen for yonks actually, but he said generally, Martin, you know, he thinks God, he looks at the past 20 years, what you've achieved, and in those 20 years, he can then move it on. You know, if you look at yourself, you know, what a job you've got now in your remaining three score years and 10 plus inflation.
And pile on the inflation, I said.
and flying the flag, you're just getting your hands dirty, aren't you, really? Which is fantastic.
No, it is lovely. And it's a great way of just supporting people. I mean, we're just beginning to see the people had come out of COVID, and most people had managed, but there was a tiredness and an exhaustion, you know, that were kind of, and people knew they had to be upbeat. And I think for people of faith, you're almost not allowed to say that you're tired or that you're losing hope a little bit. So part of the job has been about just coming alongside people and encouraging them where I can, and just saying, how are you doing? You know, having that kind of pastoral role without it being formalized.
Well, you nailed something there, because I'm looking at the time, and I know you, I don't want you to get in trouble at work, you know.
Oh, not at all. No, we're talking about NICFA. No problem.
Yeah, but the thing is, though, is that in your remaining couple of minutes, You said people are tired, you know, and I always allude at the beginning for people who are just disillusioned with church, you know, or with Christians, or for being a Christian. So looking back in your past 20 years, what can you say to encourage them?
I would say, I suppose I'm thinking of something that Martin Luther King said. It always it always sounds good if you can quote somebody.
Absolutely. One of my heroes.
Who lasted, yeah. But you have got Martin Luther King saying, the arc of time is long and it bends towards justice. And I think there is something about knowing that this is long haul kind of spirituality. And I am not sure how much you can find that in churches that just, I don't know, I don't want to be derogatory because I value immensely what churches do. And I've been supportive for most of my life of the faithfulness to encourage and keep people going. But I think when you put yourself into this different kind of space between the church and the community, and your motivation isn't evangelism, it's a difficult place to actually be in. It's a lonely place. I hear people talking about being feeling like aliens and not at home in their own place. And I think there's something about giving yourself to the process of learning how to sing the Lord's song in a strange land, if you know what I mean. I think that's something the main churches are going to have to do. You know, I think at the minute they're screaming and kicking a wee bit and want it to be the way that it always was. But I think we're in a, I'll describe it in sociological terms, a liminal space between what was and what is now. And in that liminality, we have an opportunity to learn a different way of telling this story. Of Jesus and God's recreation and a story of new beginnings. I think the old ways in which we told it, where atonement is front and center, don't work in every context. And I think that's particularly true for people who are in this kind of no man's land between church and community. That's the exhausting part. How do you tell and live out gospel values? How do you speak about gospel things in a space that there's no training manual for, if you know what I mean? And so I would say keep going. In the long grass, things will become a lot clearer, and seek out other people who you can get a feel for them being in that same kind of liminal space, and stick tight to them, you know, in terms of peer support and just meeting people regularly. And we try to do that. We've a wee series just called Grounded, and it's about getting people who are passionate about one particular practice issue and talking about how they've married that up with their faith. And it's just a coffee conversation online. Yeah. So it's doing a kind of podcasty thing, but without recording it. But we just sit, have a cup of coffee. Somebody shares what something that's really important to them, or so a practice issue, and then other people kind of contribute to it. More moments like that. We need to do so much more just to help people figure out a way in which they can retell the story, but in a way that makes a better connection for the time that we are in. I'll finish this with the story that's often told when you're doing kind of communication stuff about the minister who did a sermon, and down the right-hand side, they had a column where they would put their own personal notes in about how to deliver the sermon. And there's a bit in it that somebody once said in a talk, it said, "Argument weak, shout louder." And I just thought, is that a picture of where we actually are in terms of people wanting to communicate the story, but going back to the old techniques? That for me is a bit like argument weak, shout louder. The challenge now is learning to sing God's song in a strange land. It is a form of exile. I'm not making any comparisons to the causes of the exile, but I think we've got to see ourselves as aliens and strangers, which I think you do when you move into the world outside of the church into the community and voluntary sector. I did it through my job, through a hearing loss charity, where after years of working for the church, I started working for a charity where you just had to live your life in a transparent way. But you, as you say, you didn't go around telling everybody about Jesus by any means. That would have been a sackable offence, and rightly so. But you had to, you know, I think I found quickly the language of values, because that's common ground. It's common between all of humans. We have values by which we live our lives, and there is no harm in sharing what you value and what you say is important and what shapes how you see the world and how you understand it and what gets you up in the morning. And people are genuinely interested in that.
And I think if, from what you're saying about NICVA, that sounds like an amazing organisation. And hopefully there's going to be plenty of NICVAs back in England, Scotland, Wales, all over the world. And maybe people are going to say, do you know what? I want to do that as well. And you've not just renegotiated their life, you've just pointed them into what to do for the future, so they're no longer disillusioned. We could chat, as I said, for hours, but I'm aware of the time. I'm aware of your bosses being very nice to you as well. This has been a BCSC production, and if you want to contact us at all, you can. It's ogc@accessradio.biz, B-I-Z. Linda Gould, thank you so much. One last question, drum roll, please. You have 2 minutes, please, to discuss your Christian hero, someone who preferably is not in the Bible and is dead. That way, then we can say, yes, you know, years to come, if we play this back again, you know, everything's kosher.
Sure thing. So I do have a heroine. I have a heroine.
Even better, go for it.
Absolutely. A woman called Marva Dawn.
Okay. How do you spell that?
Marva, M-A-R-V-A, and then Dawn, as in sunrise. Marva was a theologian, a writer, a Lutheran, a professor at Regent College in Vancouver, a co-writer with Eugene Peterson, but most people don't know her as well as him.
Yeah.
But above all, she was an incredibly generous spirit. She came to Northern Ireland when I worked for Econi, and in one morning, she took us from the scope of the whole of the Bible, from Genesis right through to the book of Revelation. And by walking backwards and forwards across the room, she absolutely unlocked the wonders of the Bible, and the grand narrative, I suppose, is the best way to describe it. She just walked the floor, and you could tell from how she described herself, she just lived that, what she believed. But particularly, she wrote a book about being well when you're ill. And I think it was a lifesaver for me.
Oh, wow.
It was probably the most honest book about her own experiences and about the experiences of people for whom somebody will say, well, all things work together for good, or they'll tell you, don't worry, you'll be all right again. This book was incredibly raw and honest, but she juxtaposed good health and well-being in a biblical sense. She faced her own personal challenges. She was blind in one eye, deaf in one ear. And thank God it wasn't both. They weren't both on the one side. She had a damaged leg, which left her in chronic pain. She had cancer. She had kidney failure and had to have a kidney transplant, which left her for years on immunosuppressants. But she wrote about a kind of wellness that's not found in recovery of our bodies from illness, but it's found in a different kind of wellness in our pursuit of God. It was that was the tension. And she, I suppose, helped me understand the promise of a resurrected life that can be lived right now, the life beyond Easter Sunday, which I suppose is the one that I'd been taught that stopped in that garden and kind of had this promise of resurrection but didn't know how to do it. And the best thing she did was teach me about Sabbath rest and the importance of Sabbath, and Sabbath being a day when we are supposed to get offside and let God be God. And I think she did give a reflection on the fact that when in the creation narrative, you have a sense that a day begins with evening, and then there was morning the first day, and the pattern is evening. So it's almost like we have to go to bed for God to do work. We've got to stop trying to manipulate and try to do God's bidding. But actually, the pattern is God acts and we come in behind. So she's my heroine. She died during COVID times, and I was so sad. I hadn't even realized it or known. But she is one of those folks that forever will stand out in my mind as someone who was just such a generous spirit and had time for everyone.
And her name is Marva Dawn, M-A-R-V-A. Dawn as in opposite of sunrise, sunset thing. What's the opposite of dawn?
No, dawn is the
sunset.
Sunrise. Sunrise.
I need a coffee.
Sunrise. She's written prolifically on books, books on worship. And had a great critique of the worship wars we're all engaged in still. So look her up. I agree. Look her up. She is a great writer.
And if people could tell me what the opposite of dawn is, because my brain's gone blank.
Dusk.
Dusk. Thank you. Thank you very much indeed.
That's a whole other movie, From Dusk to Dawn.
It is. It is. Listen, you've been brilliant, Linda. Thank you so much for joining us. And if people want to contact you in light of what you said about NICFA, can they do that? How can they get hold of you?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's just Linda, Lynda, .Gould, G-O-U-L-D, at NICFA, N-I-C-V-A.org.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us today.